I am very enthusiastic about the speaker we have with us today to talk about why and how to expand your plant palette. And with us today is Mike Kinchin. He is a senior horticulturist at Denver Botanic Gardens. And not only that, but Mike has been with the Botanic Gardens more or less straight through since he was 11 years old, which might be some sort of record. He can probably tell us about that. He took a short hiatus to intern at the Chicago Botanic Garden and then at the Rhododendron Species Foundation. He holds a degree in landscape horticulture from CSU. And Mike is really an amazing person. I had the pleasure of meeting him in his own garden this spring and helping out with a garden tour event there. And while Mike is an incredible wealth of knowledge and experience, he's also a very humble guy. And I really enjoyed his energy, and I think you all will today as he tells us about his passion about gardens and plants and his travels collecting plants from around the world to contribute to the industry and specifically to our region for horticulture. So, Mike, I want to welcome you with us today. How are you today?
I'm great. Thanks for having me, Ava.
Good. You're welcome. And before we dive into today's talk, I would like to ask you a few questions about your own humble beginnings to gardening and help all the other listeners get to know you and on a more personal sort of gardening level they can relate to. So would you please tell us how you got interested in gardening and especially in your case, how you got so passionate about it at such a young age?
For as long as I can remember, I've liked plants. So even like as some of my earliest memories deal with plants. I think it's kind of an urban legend, but my parents joke that one of my first real words was flower. So I just always remember loving plants and trying to spend every moment I could with them. And I come kind of from a family that, why they aren't necessarily horticulturists, they've always gardened. Both of my sets of my grandparents gardened back in Michigan and Oklahoma and places like that. So it's quite natural that my parents had a garden around the house as well, both flower and vegetables. So plants are always around. And then as I was developing my love for plants, I found a woman who lived at the end of my cul-de-sac in the Denver area, and she was a very, very avid gardener. Both rock gardener, vegetable gardener, perennial gardener, she did it all. And she happened to be both a member of the local rock garden society, and she volunteered each Wednesday here at Denver Botanic Gardens in the rock garden with Panayota Killides. So she took me kind of under her wing, so to say, around 9, 10. And by age 11, she brought me down here to the Botanic Gardens to help volunteer on Wednesdays in the summers when I wasn't in school, and she got me involved in the local Rock Garden Society and also the National Rock Garden Society at that age. So I've been at it for a while, and it was great to have both my parents and then that neighbor that really kind of helped mentor me.
Yeah, I'd say that you are extremely fortunate to have met her and have such a great guide to introduce you to those various activities and organizations. That's fortunate for you, and I'd say it's fortunate for all of us now because we get to benefit from the fruits of your labors and your career. So thanks to her. Are you still in touch with her? Is she still around?
She moved back to Arkansas where she was originally from. So we've tried to stay in touch, but, you know, sometimes it's hard when people move away.
Yeah, definitely. And so thank you for sharing that story with us, Mike. And would you also share with us Well, you grew up in the Denver area, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
And you obviously live there now. So for anyone, I know we do have a lot of listeners around the Denver area, but for anyone further afield than that, can you just remind us what the conditions are like around there and in your particular area as far as soil elevation and USDA hardiness zone?
Okay, we're here in the metro area. We're like zone 5, borderline zone 6. Definitely we can get away with a lot of zone 6 and maybe even some zone 7 plants in protected microclimates. It's a semi-arid climate. We're at about 5,300 feet above sea level. It's generally frost-free from about mid-May to about the first week of October. Our soils tend to be heavy clay, and at both my parents' house in Littleton, where I grew up and where I garden now in central Denver, it's a heavier clay soil.
Okay. Have you personally found that to be a challenge at all, or since you, that's all you've ever known, has it just been like, yeah, that's how you garden?
Tended to be kind of how I garden. A lot of people curse clay. I've learned to like it. As long as you don't overwater, a lot of things grow really well in it. Even in my parents' Littleton clay, which was kind of this heavy reddish clay, it was amazing what I was able to grow in that. And even working a little bit of compost in helped things just take off. And I didn't have to water as much because it was a nice clay soil, held onto the moisture. And then now where I garden, the soil's more of a dark alluvial clay because I'm in the Cherry Creek floodplain, and even that grows plants amazingly well. My mom will come by and comment on just how big things are in comparison to even at their house.
Uh-huh.
And if I have any drainage problems, I just build a berm for the rock garden plants.
Mm-hmm. Great. Sounds good. All right. So why don't we go ahead and dive into why and how people, gardeners in the West, can expand their plant palettes. Why don't we start off, Mike, with you sharing a little bit on your views about why it's important to grow a wide variety of plants.
I think it's important because there's a couple of things that you can accomplish by expanding the variety of plants that you grow in your garden. For me, the number one thing is year-round interest. A lot of people think here in the Mountain West that we have a short growing season, so they tend to think about gardening maybe from May to September and then hang it up. But with a wide array of plants, in most elevations, as long as you don't have tremendous snow cover, you can have a garden that's beautiful year-round, as long as it's not completely buried under snow. So with choosing a wide variety of plants, you know, you use some broadleafed evergreens, some ornamental grasses. A lot of the rock garden plants stay evergreen or have structure. And then there's things like bulbs and some early blooming and late blooming plants that can really, really stretch your season. Here in the metropolitan area, we can have flowers almost every month of the year by picking different plants. They may not be show-stopping in December, January, but there can always be something blooming, or as I mentioned, there's that structure or some evergreen components of plants that will make your garden really beautiful 365 days a year. Another reason for me is just increasing biodiversity in your own yard. By selecting a wide variety of plants, you can kind of create some miniature ecosystems. In some respects, they may not necessarily mirror the native ecosystem that your garden may have replaced, but you can bring in a lot of local wildlife and insects such as butterflies and bees and different pollinators like that by a wide array of plants that gives a pollen source or shelter throughout different periods of the year when things need it. And just growing plants in your yard is great instead of just having, you know, three or four plants like bluegrass or junipers and maybe a silver maple. Instead, maybe in your suburban yard you could have hundreds of species, which is great. I think it's a way as more and more natural habitats are changed and altered by humanity to try and bring a little bit of this variety into our own gardens, as long as we do it in a sustainable and responsible manner. Obviously, you don't want to grow plants that are invasive or stuff like that, but choosing plants that adapt well to your climate but don't necessarily adapt so well that they become problematic.
Mm-hmm.
And then another reason would be to help just raising the awareness, as I talked about, of habitats being destroyed and where these plants actually come from. I think a lot of people, when they visit the garden center, they're interested, definitely, there's some romanticism about a plant that comes from, say, South Africa or
mm-hmm.
the steppes of Central Asia or some snowy peak in the southern Andes. But I think by growing these different plants from these different regions of the world, we raise people's awareness that preserving these natural ecosystems is important, and that's really the only way that we're going to preserve biodiversity. Yes, gardening, zoos and botanic gardens and other things like that are all great ways of kind of taking a little piece of that and helping to keep it alive in your own backyard or in an institution like a botanic garden or zoo. But really the only way that we're going to truly help protect biodiversity is by raising that awareness that natural areas do count in a civilized world. And I think when people see, you know, that there's a certain plant from South Africa or Morocco or Japan even, it kind of sets off a little light maybe that, okay, yes, there are a lot of beautiful ecosystems in the world and we need to work towards helping to preserve those.
Yes, I love that idea. It's the whole thing about, slogan is by think global, think global, buy local. Is that the same?
Yes, yeah.
Did I get it right? Didn't sound quite right. But yeah, that applied to
close
the
enough,
garden.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, sometimes those things you hear too many times just stop making sense of the words themselves. But I think everyone will know what I'm getting at here. And just to apply that to the garden and our own home space, being able to practice that sort of ideal and think about the whole world and the health of the ecosystems globally and relates to how we practice in our own yards and gardens. So I love that idea, Mike. Thank you for bringing that point to us.
Sure. The other thing that it helps is by buying these new and kind of unusual plants that may not be that common in commerce yet, you're supporting programs like Plant Select, which is a great program, as I'm sure most of the listeners know about, that it's a cooperation between Denver Botanic Gardens, Colorado State University, and then the local green industry to promote underused plants that do well in the Rocky Mountain region that are not invasive. And then you're also supporting places like DBG and the Rock Garden Society and some of the other societies that kind of feed into some of these other programs and institutions.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And DBG being Denver Botanic Gardens, in case we didn't spell that out and anyone missed it. That's what we're talking about. Great. And, for anyone who is listening and might have missed it, in the original series that I did with Abundant Earth Gardens, we had Pat Hayward on as a guest speaker, and she is the executive director of Plant Select, and her talk was very interesting and accompanied by just some eye-popping slides. Her photos were amazing. So that's something to look for if you want to know more about that program. And Mike, do you want to suggest some plants that you think would be great for folks to have in their gardens that they may not be familiar with?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Let's start kind of, I think we'll go through kind of the calendar year, because that might make sense.
Yeah, I like
for
that.
People, so we'll start at the beginning of the year. So there's hellebores, the Lenten roses, are great and they do well throughout the Rocky Mountain region. They tend to be more shade-loving plants, so they're great for those kind of dry, shady areas where you might have something challenging. And what's really nice about the various species and hybrids that have come out is they tend to flower very, very early. Some years here in Denver, they'll start as early as Thanksgiving.
Wow.
And one of the common names is actually Christmas rose for one of the species, which is Helleborus niger. And that's almost always reliably in bloom here for Christmas. If we have a really hard winter, maybe January. But
wow.
It's a great winter blooming plant. And then there's the latter ones, the actual Lenten rose blooms more around, as its common name, around Lent in February, March, and April. And then there's some other species that are a little bit rare. It doesn't have a very nice common name, but the stinking hellebore, Helleborus fetidus, is a great evergreen plant for really harsh, dry shade. It is almost completely xeric in a lot of situations. It might need just a little bit of water when it gets really hot and dry in the summer, or if we have just a really open, dry winter with very little snow, you might give it one or two drinks just to kind of help it along. But it's been kind of, in my opinion, one of those overlooked plants that it's so useful for those really harsh situations that I wish more people would use it. And then
does
moving
it
on
stink?
Into the year, there's things. It does if you crush the leaves.
Okay.
Yeah, if you actually, like, drove over it with a car macerated and it smells unpleasant, but it's not, it doesn't scent the garden or anything.
Great.
So, because I tried one. kind of moving through the year, you get, there's winter heather as well, the Erica carnea hybrids. A lot of people are surprised that we can actually do an Erica here, and it's one that tolerates alkaline soils. So as long as the drainage is good and you give it a little bit of winter shade, it's a great plant, and it comes in whites, pinks, and then there's even like a bright kind of dark shade of pink, almost magenta. And they start blooming in February most years, so they can kind of form like a nice massive color for a month or two because the weather stays so cool that the blossoms last for a long, long time. And then there's a lot of bulbous plants. I know a lot of people are familiar with crocus and even like Glory of the Snow and some of those, but I still don't think that people use those as much as they should. Bulbs tend to be very, very cheap, and if you get them in the right spot, they last for years, and especially a lot of the species ones, so like those little snow crocus or the Glories of the Snow, Chonodox is the Latin name, or the Siberian squill, the Scilla siberica, those tend to multiply, and from just a handful of bulbs, in a reasonable amount of time, you can have sheets of color, which is great. And one thing to keep in mind, kind of tying back in with that conservation aspect behind this talk, a lot of bulbs used to be wild collected out of their native homes, and now the Dutch are very, very good at mass-producing bulbs. So even a lot of the species bulbs, like the little crocus or some of the wild tulips that people may have seen, are generally almost all produced in cultivation now, and that's great because you're buying them from a sustainable source. They're not being wild-collected and depleting native populations. But going along with those bulbs that are a little more common, there's some genera that people may not be quite as familiar with. And one of my favorite genera is the Corydalis. And the common name, I think, is actually worse than the Latin name. It's Fumewort. And I don't like that common name, so I go with Corydalis. And it's a really, really big genus covering both plants that are bulbs and then plants that behave like regular perennials. And it's really the ones that come from bulbs that do very, very well in our climate because they come generally from the steppe climates of Central Asia, which are a parallel climate to most of the climates that we garden in here in the Intermountain West. So I'm going to throw out a kind of a long list of Latin names, but I think there'll be a handout that goes along with this and a slideshow, so people will be able to see images and then see the name as well. So one of my favorites, and some of these names are kind of fun, is Caryllus shalangii variety Anii, which is from Kazakhstan, and it's a bright baby pink with yellow parts in it. So it's a very kind of Easter-looking bulb, and it generally blooms right around Easter. And it's just a stunning plant. It's a little bit harder to get. There's another company out there for some of these rarer bulbs called Odyssey Bulbs, and they're online. And he tends to sell most of these rare bulbs. Another great one is Corydalis angustifolia, and it's a white or pale pink one. And that one has tended to love DBG and is actually seeding around. We're getting nice big colonies of it. The shalangii variety Anii is a little bit, it hasn't self-sowed for us yet. And the bulbs on the Corydalis, a lot of gardeners will be set back a little bit by the price. They can be about $10 to $15 per bulb, but they're definitely worth it. When they bloom, people will go nuts over them. And then related to shalangii is just the straight species. Corydalis shalangii itself. And that one, instead of having the yellow in it, is just pink and white with a maroon dot. So it's equally as striking, just not as bright. And then if you want a Corydalis that's not quite as expensive but performs just as well as the others, there's good old Corydalis solida, which is actually a native, I think, from Turkey on into Europe. And that one, if you get different forms of it, it will seed around and create just carpets of color in the spring. And it comes anywhere from white through baby pink to hot pink to kind of dusky purples to blues to approaching almost brick red. It's
wow,
a really great plant. And there's one garden in Fort Collins where the woman who has it, she ordered many years ago really nice different strains of that Caryllus solida, and they've self-sowed throughout her garden, and it's just sheets of color in the spring. It's, in my opinion, one of the greatest private gardens in the state. And then going back to a genus that people would be a little more familiar with are the iris. A lot of people know the bearded iris, and some people are probably definitely familiar with the dwarfed iris that bloom really early in the spring. But there's things like iris reticulata, which comes in shades of blue and purple. And it blooms really early here in Denver, February, March. I've seen it in high elevation gardens in April, May. So it blooms as soon as the snow is gone. And that one's easier to get. You'll see that in local garden centers along with your crocus and stuff like that in the fall. Or another good source would be Brent and Becky's bulbs online. You can get a lot of different bulbs there at very reasonable prices. And then tying in with iris, there's a whole other category of iris called the arrowbred iris, which are related to bearded iris, and that bearded iris were used to partially breed them with a group of iris called arrow iris that are actually generally a little more difficult to grow, except actually they love the arid Intermountain West because, once again, they come from a steppe climate. So they do very, very well here. And they can be a little bit harder to find, but they're starting to pop up. There's some mail order nurseries for them. There's even an arrow iris society, and they bloom more in May, kind of right before the bearded iris, but they're great for a hot, dry, sunny xeric area. If you have a really hot, dry spot where you just struggle with stuff, they're great for that because they go dormant during the summer, and they're okay getting very, very dry. And if you have even sandy, dry soils, there's a local garden where they've done beautifully in that pure sand that has been really difficult to grow a lot of even xeric stuff in just because it gets so dry.
Wow, that's
and
a great one.
Kind of moving on.
That's a great one to know about. And
yeah.
Make sure just kind of underline what you said, because I, as a garden consultant, get asked that question a lot. What will grow in my super, super hot, really, really dry area? And so to have some plants that have some answers for that question, I think is great. So I just hope people who need that are hearing that. The arrow iris, awesome. Sounds gorgeous.
Yeah, they're great, great plants.
Yeah.
And then spring is easy. Generally, kind of once you get through those early bulbs, you know, there's the species tulips and there's daffodils, which are all great, but people tend to know those. So we'll kind of skip into another category of plants that blooms from April all the way generally. I still have some of them blooming now, and those are the erodiums or the stork's bill. Those are related to the common garden geranium, the perennial ones that a lot of people know, like the bloody crane's bill, Geranium sanguineum. It's a genus that's very closely related, but they tend to have an even longer bloom season, and they tend to be smaller plants, which sometimes people are turned off when I say, oh, these are smaller plants, generally, you know, 6 inches to maybe 12 inches high. They're like, oh, that's too small for my yard. But these plants, despite their small size, really kind of pack a big punch. And as I mentioned, a lot of the different erodiums bloom from April all the way to now. So one of my favorite ones is Erodium absinthioides, and it's just called the blue form, because most erodiums are not blue, but this one is kind of a lavender blue, making it a very unusual color for that genus. And it came to me from a nursery in the Bay Area. And Plant Select is kind of looking into making it more widely available.
Okay.
So at this point in time, it's not available, but I think it's going to be coming down the pipeline through tissue culture. And it literally blooms, I think, starting in April, and it's going strong again now. It did stop this past summer in July and August just because Denver had, I think, 72 days above 90. And it, July and August were just, it was really harsh for both plants and people. So they stopped, but they lived through it. And now once September came, they started blooming again. But there's a bunch of other erodiums to look for. Plant Select came out with one called Erodium chrysanthemum, which is a very soft, creamy yellow. And that's a workhorse in the garden as well. It blooms pretty much nonstop from April to now as well. And it's a really great plant. And so people should look for those. Moving into kind of another genus that starts with E, there's the buckwheats or the areogonums. And these are actually native in the American West. That's their whole center of distribution, meaning that the majority of the species are found here. They kind of radiate out from California and places like Colorado. You find a few species in the eastern U.S., but the majority of them are here. And one of the ones that listeners are probably familiar with is the sulfur flower. You see this all over the American West with the kind of bright yellow flowers. And a lot of people may even be growing it in their garden. And Plant Select came out with a cultivar called Kenna Creek a couple years ago. And it's a great plant. It blooms in May and June down here in Denver. But then what I love about it is as the seed heads ripen, it doesn't lose its ornamental characteristics. They kind of turn rust-colored, and they can hang on for quite a few months. So even after it's flowering, you have this presence in the garden. And then going along, as I mentioned, about expanding how your garden looks through the non-growing season, through the winter months, the great thing about a lot of the areogonums is they tend to be broadleafed evergreens. They may not always be a bright evergreen in color in the winter. And in the case of Areogonum umbellatum, the sulfur flower, it turns kind of a maroony red color. So you get this beautiful mound in the garden when it's not snow-covered that's got a smoky maroon red that's just great. And people love that. And I think a lot of people don't necessarily think about how the garden's going to look in the winter, but it's a great plant that you can kind of contrast with your tawny ornamental grasses, maybe your evergreens in there, or even a yucca. It can create a really nice little vignette, just a couple plants, and you have something that looks beautiful year-round. Another species I like is actually from the east. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Is from the eastern U.S., and it's Eriogonum alleinii. And despite being from the eastern U.S., it's extremely drought tolerant because it comes from the shale barrens of the Virginians. And it's unusual from some of the spring flowering Eriogonums in that it waits to bloom in July, August, and September. So it's a great plant if you need something that's going to bloom in those months. And as I mentioned, it's very, very drought tolerant. We have it in some very hot sites here, Denver Botanic Gardens, and also at home. Another Eriogonum that I like is another Western native, and it's Eriogonum avolifolium. And that's a dwarf one. It's more of a rock garden plant or a trough plant or a container plant. And it tends to bloom more May, June, but then it has silver leaves, so you have kind of this nice silver cushion even when it's not in flower. And then two others in that genus that really should be grown more often is there's a brushy Eriogonum that you can find throughout the western part of the U.S. here, west of the Rockies, called Eriogonum corymbosum. And it's a pretty cool plant because it's very variable. It can be, I've seen plants in northern Arizona that are 4 by 4 feet and bright yellow growing along the highway. And they were still looking good even in early January. And it's a plant that flowers in the autumn. So it has enough presence that it stays through the winter. But then it makes it all the way up into places like Wyoming and northwest Colorado and into Utah, and some of those forms, which I have in my garden, are a little smaller. They're maybe only about 15 to 18 inches tall and wide, and they tend to bloom a little bit earlier, starting in August again. And then those forms have been white in my experience, and they fade to pink and then eventually rust. So they're in their rust stage right now, which is great. I think rust is a really nice color for the autumn garden. It kind of contrasts very nicely with some of the other colors going on. And then there's even some small yellow forms out of Utah that people have collected. And I think High Country Gardens is promoting one called Henrysville Yellow. And they're really great plants. I hope that someday maybe Plant Select will look into promoting one of the various forms of that plant because it's so variable, so drought tolerant, so heat tolerant. It's a wonderful plant. I think it should be in every landscape here in the U.S. And one last one is Eriogonum ridii, variety ridii, which is one that Plant Select is promoting. They're calling it the Snow Mesa Buckwheat. And it's another late summer flowering plant, so it starts, I think, in August. It has white flowers again, and then it fades to pink and then eventually rust again. And it's just very, very textural in the garden throughout its whole stage. Even after the flowers have fallen off, you have this kind of broom-like structure that's rust-colored in the garden. So I leave it till March in the garden. It's great. And I wish more people would be using that plant because, once again, with the other Eriogonums, it's very heat-tolerant, very drought-tolerant. A lot of the animals don't tend to bother them, so they don't tend to be grazed by deer or elk if you have those problems. And I think they may even be rabbit resistant, but of course that always varies with your local population of rabbits, what they like. So that kind of ties up the Eriogonums. And then moving along into another genus that I'm very fond of at the moment are the salvias. And a lot of people know salvias because they're a big, big genus. They're cosmopolitan, which means you find them pretty much throughout the world. So they grow from the tropics up into North America here, down into as far south as Argentina and Chile. You find them again in South Africa, in the steppes of Central Asia, in Europe. A lot of them have already made it into gardens. A lot of people know, like, Maynite salvia or the red salvia that's used as an annual in pots, Salvia splendens. But some of my personal favorites are Salvia ringens, which this is another plant that listeners will have to be kind of patient about because it's not in the trade yet. Denver Botanic Gardens and Plant Select are working at trying to get it out there to people because it's one of those great plants. It blooms from May to September, or maybe even October. Unlike some of the other plants I've spoken about today, it's a larger plant. It can be 4 to 5 feet tall. So it's great for different parts of the border, or if you just need something very structural in the garden, it's great for that. It was one of the most asked about plants on a garden tour that I had in June. And so look for that in the near future. I think Plant Select is looking at it as we speak. And then another plant that I like, a lot of people are probably familiar with some of the salvias that Plant Select did come out with, such as Salvia Wild Thing and Furman's Red, which are the Salvia Greggii. But there's some other hybrids involving Salvia Greggii. And my personal favorite at the moment is Salvia Raspberry Delight. It's a woody plant, actually. So treated as a smaller shrub in the landscape, it gets maybe about 4 by 4 feet if it really likes you. But once again, like that Salvia ringens, it blooms pretty much nonstop from May to now. So that's pretty awesome that you can have a plant in full bloom for 5 or 6 months. And because it's just like its name suggests, it's kind of a raspberry color. So I have seen hummingbirds on it. So it is great for bringing some wildlife and pollinators into the garden.
Is that one available?
And another salvia. It is. It's available through High Country Gardens.
Great.
I think
Thanks.
David Solomon is actually the breeder on it.
Mm-hmm.
So readers and listeners can definitely find it.
Perfect.
And I've even seen it at a few local garden centers here in Denver.
Great, thanks.
And then one other salvia that I'm very fond of is Salvia jurisicii, and this is kind of a May-June bloomer. So it blooms kind of in that big wave of flowers that we experience in May and June in our gardens. But it's a nice blue salvia, dark blue, and I think it's a nice alternative to things like Maynite and maybe East Friesland, some of those more common ones, because it's a lot more drought-tolerant. And it's from the Balkans, so places like the former Yugoslavia, Greece, places like that. So it can take a lot of heat and drought. And what it does, if it gets just too dry in the summer, it simply goes dormant. And it comes back when things cool off in the autumn. And if we have a good autumn, it may even rebloom. So it's kind of cool. You can get two blooms on it, one in May and June, and then one again perhaps in September and October. This year, just because it was such a long, hot, dry summer, I'm not getting any rebloom on it, but it has definitely reappeared. But it's one of those plants that I love because, it, as I mentioned, it just goes dormant, and you don't have to worry about dragging the hose to it when it's 105 degrees. I think that's the other reason I like a lot of those early spring bulbs, is that they just go dormant when it's hot and dry, and you don't have to worry about them.
Mm-hmm.
And then moving through kind of the season, there's a few other plants. There's some ornamental grasses that I think people should think about. And my personal favorite, or two favorites at the moment, if I had to pick two, would be Mullenbergia rivershonii. This is the autumn embers, Mully. And this was made popular by Lauren Springer Ogden. And it's a great grass. It blooms a little bit later than some of the other ornamental grasses that we're familiar with, like Carl Forrester, or even some of the Miscanthus. It really doesn't come into its own until about September. And it's, if you can kind of imagine like this pink cloud, misty pink cloud settling down to earth that kind of describes this grass. And I think one of the reasons that I'm so fond of it is that it's really a smaller to mid-sized grass. A little bit shorter, actually, than Carl Forrester, and maybe just a tad bit wider. A well-grown clump might be 3, maybe 4 feet wide, if that. So it can fit in landscapes that some of those large ornamental grasses that are so beautiful in the fall just kind of swamp. I think everyone is looking for a smaller ornamental grass that will fit in along with like little blue stem and some of those great natives. And this is a native to Texas and Oklahoma, so it's definitely very, very heat tolerant. Here in the Intermountain West, it's not fully xeric. You do need to give it some water for it to truly perform. In my home garden, which I only water about once or twice a month during the heat of the summer, it doesn't perform quite as well as it has in my experience at Denver Botanic Gardens, where it gets weekly watering. It's been spectacular there. So I would recommend at least maybe every 2 weeks that it gets a good deep soaking to really perform. And it is available through some local garden centers, and High Country Gardens is marketing it, and LaPorte Avenue Nursery has it mail order. And then another ornamental grass that I'm really fond of, it's another kind of smaller to mid-sized ornamental grass. I'm really big on those right now because I think there's a lot of ornamental grasses that are very large, that are very striking, but they may not always fit in people's landscapes. So these smaller to mid-sized ones are more on a scale that people can integrate into their own garden. And it has a Latin name of Acnanthrum calamagrostis, and they've given it the common name silver spike grass. And it's actually native to the European Alps. You see it there growing, ironically enough, on rocky hillsides or cliffs or even avalanche chutes. So it's a very adaptable plant. And once again, Lauren Springer was able to bring to America a selected form that she found in Austria in the public gardens there. It's really an outstanding ornamental form of this grass, and it's available through High Country Gardens. I think what I love about this grass is it has an extremely long season of interest. While the autumn molly starts in September and is beautiful through most of the winter, this blooms in May and June. So it's a good ornamental grass for those at higher elevations. Up there, I've seen it. It looks great in gardens. You know, it might start flowering in July, August, September at that elevation. But even though it flowered way back in May and June here in Denver, it's still stunning right now in the Rock Alpine Garden here at Denver Botanic Gardens. The heads have turned kind of this silvery blonde color, hence the common name silver spike grass. And with the low autumnal light coming through it, with that pink molly grass, it's just it's amazing right now. I took a photo a couple days ago and put it on Facebook, and people went nuts over it. So definitely look for that grass. It's well worth it. A couple other plants that I'm big on. Acantholinums, these are the prickly thrifts. These are a little harder to find because they can be hard to propagate. They are basically little spiny hedgehogs, is one way to think of it, and they're native to Central Asia. They form these cushions of spiny silver or green leaves, and they do have a pink flower in May and June and even July. But then what I'm so big about them is that they are truly a plant that looks great 365 days a year. After they flower, the seed heads that form look like these little the birdie that you play badmintons with. So you have this spike of these little silver birdies. It's really pretty in the garden. And they'll last from July to October, November, December, till we get a really heavy wet snow. So they're very, very textural even after they flower. And then as I alluded to, they tend to be evergreen. So you have these silver or bright green cushions throughout the year. So even in the winter garden, there's a lot of nice presence with them, some structure and some color as well. And once again, kind of the theme, I guess, running through my plant choices is a lot of them are very heat and drought tolerant because these come from Central Asia, which has a climate very similar to ours. They'll put up with almost anything we throw at them except overwatering. Very, very sensitive to overwatering. They're not hard to grow, but just put them in some place where your sprinkler actually doesn't hit. If you need another plant for that really hot, dry place that drains really well, the prickly thrift or acanthellums are the plant for you. And naturally, because they're prickly, deer, elk, and rabbits really can't touch them because they're very, very sharp. The cushions are as sharp as a cactus. It doesn't mean that they're going to stick in you, but definitely people want to bend down and pet them because they look very pettable, these cushions, but they're sharp, and people immediately learn, okay, that's a plant that I don't want to necessarily bend down and pet. But great plants, you can find those at some of the Denver Botanic Garden sales. Often the Rock Garden Society will throw a plant sale in April here at the Denver Botanic Gardens. They sometimes make an appearance at that. Their main reason that you don't find them in garden centers is, unfortunately, they are a little difficult to propagate right now, but propagators are working with them and trying to figure out how to make them more available to the public. And then a couple other plants, and then we'll finish up my list of recommended things. I think everyone knows the classic snapdragon, but some people may not know that there are actually perennial species in that genus. And one of my favorites is Antirrhinum sempervirens. I don't know if it has a common name, but it's a long-blooming white perennial snapdragon. So it lives from year to year, and it tends to bloom. There's a big peak again in May and June. It'll flower sporadically throughout the growing season. And this plant came to Denver Botanic Gardens from a nursery in California, and initially we weren't sure it was going to be hardy because people said, oh, it's only hardy to 0 degrees if you look in books or online. But it sailed through about 15 below here in Denver through several winters that we've had it. And I even have it under a juniper tree at home where it doesn't get a lot of protecting snow on it, and it gets a lot of wind whipping under the juniper, and it's done fine. And so I'm actually recommending it may be a nice plant, again, for an area that's partly shady and dry, because it's done very, very well in that situation. It's not a dark, shady corner. I don't think it would work in a situation like that. But under this juniper tree, it gets just a couple hours of direct sunlight, and it's very, very dry because the juniper keeps all the rain or snow off of it. And it's performed really, really well. So I think that that's a plant that people should be on the lookout for. Local nurseries are starting to promote it. And you, if you can't find it at your local nursery, you can buy it online. There's several nurseries that would send it to you from California. And then kind of wrapping up, just a couple other. There's a one allium that I would mention. It's a dwarf little allium from the Himalayas. It's the Allium cyaneum, the miniature blue form. It's the particular one that I'm fond of. And it's a very short little allium. It's only about 4 to 6 inches tall. It's a bright gentian blue color. Very, very nice cobalt blue. And once again, it blooms in August, when a lot of gardens can be kind of tired looking and it's hot. So that kind of cobalt refreshing blue color is very nice. And then two other plants to finish up kind of the growing season. I could go on and on about great, great plants, but one that I'm really fond of is Vernonia Lindheimeri, and it's the variety Leucophylla. So this is a butterfly weed, I think is the ironweed is the common name that they've given these plants. And they're in the aster family, and they tend to come in kind of purples and mauves and magentas. And so there's Vernonia lindheimeri leucrophylla. It has these silver leaves with these nice kind of lavendery purple flowers up top. It's about 3.5 feet tall. It tends to be upright, so it's not that wide, maybe about a foot to a foot and a half wide so far in my garden. And it waits to bloom till August, September. But I love it because it has those bright silver leaves, so as soon as it starts growing in the spring, it's kind of this magnet in the garden, and people are like, what is that? What is that? And then once the lavender purple flowers come on it in the autumn, that contrast between the silver and the purple is just a wonderful plant. And now that it's gone into ripe seed, it's even still stunning, even though we've had some several hard frosts here in Denver. So it definitely pays the rent, as I say, in the garden. And then one final plant to wrap it up would be probably an aster. I think a lot of people kind of tend to overlook asters because you see them on the roadsides and in pastures and in meadows. But I love any plant that kind of evokes those natural habitats. So anything daisy-like for me, is I throw it in my garden because it truly represents those natural ecosystems in the world. It's very hard to step into an ecosystem anywhere in the world and not find some kind of flower that follows that daisy pattern. So my favorite aster at the moment is one called Aster ericoides snowflurry. And it's a dwarf, low-growing aster with white flowers in the autumn. It only gets about 6 inches high, maybe, and about 3 feet wide. So kind of think of it as like a ground cover aster. And it's been, once again, very heat and drought tolerant for me. I have it in two spots in my home garden, and one is next to the sidewalk on the south side of the house, so it's really hot, really dry, and it's performed beautifully there. And that is available, I think, both online if you Google it. And then there's a couple local nurseries that might be selling it as well. So that would kind of wrap up my list of plants that I probably couldn't live without.
Well, I feel like you have given us a wealth of information here as characteristic of your style as I know it. And I really appreciate it. And all the...
Sure.
The great resources, not only the nurseries, but the places to go to learn more about these plants. As you've mentioned, Plant Select, Denver Botanic, the Rock Garden Societies, including the Rocky Mountain chapter. So then they all have great websites too. I've been to all of them and search around them fairly regularly and have fun there. So I just want to thank you so much, Mike, for sharing your time and information with us today. It's really been wonderful.
Sure, it was a pleasure, and thank you again for asking me.
You're very welcome. You enjoy the rest of your day.
Thanks, you as well.
Thank you. Bye-bye, and goodbye to everyone else who joined us today. Be well.